Texting between two different kinds of phones makes photos blurry, ugly, and security risky. Not just that, it also makes video calling, editing messages, or leaving a group nearly impossible. With WhatsApp, everyone can enjoy seamless messaging with the protection of end-to-end encryption. Streamline your messages across all devices on WhatsApp. Message privately with anyone you want. Click the banner or download now to learn more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The narrative of details are unprintable primarily unfolds over a seven-month period from October 1943 to April 1944, from the moment the body of 22-year-old Patricia Burton Lonergan is discovered in the bedroom of her New York City Beekman Hill apartment, to the arrest of her husband of 2 years, Wayne Lonergan, for her murder and his subsequent trial and conviction. But this story goes back in time to the 1920s when Wayne Lonergan grew up in Toronto, and then forward to his post-prison life following his deportation to Canada. It is the chronicle of Lonergan in denial as a bisexual or gay man living in an intolerant and morally superior heterosexual world, and of Patricia, rich and entitled, a seeker of attention, who loved the night out on the town, all set against the fast-paced of New York's ostentatious cafe society. Part true crime and part a social history of New York City in the 1940s, this book transports readers to the New York World's Fair of 1939, when Patricia's father, William Burton, first encountered Lonergan, the Stork Club, 21 Club, and El Morocco to experience with Patricia a night of drinking, champagne cocktails, and dancing, and the muggy New York courtroom where Lonergan's fate was decided. What truly happened on that tragic night on October 24, 1943? Should we accept Lonergan's confession at face value, as the jury did? Or was he indeed a victim of physical and mental abuse by the state prosecutors and the police, as he maintained for the rest of his life? This book considers these and other key questions. The book that we're featuring this evening is Details Are Unprintable, Wayne Lonergan and the Sensational Cafe Society Murder, with my special guest, historian, journalist, and author, Alan Levine. Thank you very much for this interview, and welcome to the program. First off, tell us how you came to want and be the author of this book.
I'm an historian. I've written many nonfiction books, generally different kinds of European, some Jewish content. But in any event, I had been looking for, I was always fascinated by true crime. I also have written some historical mysteries set in the early 19th century. So, you know, is this a genre that appealed to me? And it's, you know, as you know, it's very difficult to find a true crime that hasn't been done before, or, and also the documentation to tell the story properly and some originality. In any event, I had been leafing, or I guess looking through on a computer screen, old copies of Cosmopolitan magazine, and I came across an article by Raymond Chandler, the great detective novelist, from Cosmopolitan in October 1948, in which he has his, and he lists for the magazine 10 greatest crimes of the century. And the first one was the Lindbergh kidnapping, which was in the 30s and still famous. But number nine was this case involving Wayne Lonergan that I had never heard of. And the case was interesting for the first reason it was interesting was that it was involved a Canadian. Lonergan had, as you said, had been born in Toronto. So that sort of was interesting. And I started digging into the case and realized there had been two books, one written in the 50s by a TV columnist, which was, you know, basically just lifted from newspaper articles. And there had been another book written in early 70s by a Florida crime writer named Hamilton Darby Perry. And I got a hold of that book and, you know, he had actually interviewed Lonergan before he died. But there's stuff in the book that just didn't sit well. And then the thing that really got me into it was that I started digging into where the district attorney files were on these kinds of cases. And I discovered that in New York, more than most states, to be honest, and you can get access to this stuff at the New York Municipal Archives. And lo and behold, they had this fantastic collection, over 1,600 pages of the district attorney's files from the case in the trial in 44, as well as there was an appeal in the mid 60s. So they had all that document, and I was able to get access to it, get it digitized, get it shipped to me into my home in Winnipeg, Canada. And I discovered that it was just fantastic. It had witness testimonies, financial information of Patricia Lonergan, biographies of people that I never would have been able to find information for. And private correspondence between the police and the lawyers, and just really laid out the entire case, Lonergan's confession, his alibi initially. I mean, and just every possible aspect of the case. So I thought this is fantastic. And I knew that I could tell the story in a much more detailed way. And as you said, my aim was to not just tell the story of the murder, but to also put the murder in some kind of context. Because I discovered right away that the case also had a morality issue to it about Lonergan's homosexuality. And in the period under, you know, 1930s and 40s, this was an issue that was extremely controversial. And it does taint the trial, as I note. And it also played a sort of a strange part in Lonergan's story, because he himself never admitted to his own sexuality. And in fact, when in Hamilton Darby Perry's book, it's not mentioned at all, or briefly mentioned anyways. But years later, before Hamilton Darby Perry died, he did make a note in another edition of his book published by a specialized publisher that he did believe Wayne was bisexual or homosexual. But that certainly affected his whole life. And it comes up in all sorts of strange ways throughout Wayne's life, but certainly during the story of the case itself, where It's an excuse. In fact, it plays a part in his initial alibi when he's questioned by the district attorney's office and the police. So that's really how I came to it. And I found it to be a fascinating story.
Let's get to this. Yes, truly fascinating story. You take us to New York City initially, October 24th, 1943. Patricia Burton Lonergan, her friends call her Patsy. She's called a classy dame and is a daughter of a wealthy, assimilated German-Jewish family, rich and spoiled.
Yes.
Tell us about this last evening of her life. You say by 6:30 a.m., she'd been out for close to 16 hours on a date. Tell us about New York Cafe Society, as you write about, and tell us about Patricia Burton Lonergan.
Well, you know, first of all, she's only 22. Even though in the photographs, it's probably the hairstyle and just the way people held themselves in those days. They're both young. I mean, you know, Lonergan's only 25. She's 22. They were only married for a short time before they had problems. They got married in 41, had a child in July 42, and then were separated by the summer of 1943. So a couple months before the murder took place. Patricia is, you know, she was brought up in a very wealthy environment. Her family, as you said, had German-Jewish roots, rather. Her grandfather, great-grandfather, I guess it would have been, came from Germany as an immigrant, started a beer business. and became fairly wealthy. And it would, and his son, that would have been her grandfather, built upon the business. And so they lived a very high lifestyle. Her father, William, the family's name was actually Bernheimer. And later, when Patricia's father was older, in his 20, or when he turned 21, I guess, him and his brother changed the name to Burton. It was like this was during the First World War. Partially, he says, because he was being discriminated against because of a German-sounding name, but really probably also because he was Jewish, and despite attempts to lead a rather assimilated life, he was probably just trying to fit in he wasn't certainly the only New York Jew with German roots who lived a fairly secular life to do this. I mean, they belonged to a Reform synagogue, and so that was that was part of their story. William Burton is an interesting character because he probably too was bisexual, which plays into a little bit of the story later on. But he marries because in those days, you know, homosexuality or bisexuality was not talked about, and you were expected to get married, and he ends up marrying this woman, Lucille, who comes from also an old moneyed family, although they had lost some of their money. They came from the Deep South and lost some of their money during the Civil War. Louise Wolfe, her name was. And they end up getting married. They, too, also have a lousy marriage, partially, I think, because of the sexual issues. And she was, you know, she expected a lot out of life. But they lived, you know, Patricia was born in 1921. They lived this rather idyllic lifestyle. They lived part of the year in New York in fancy Park Avenue apartment. She was brought up by nannies, like as it was common among wealthy people in those days. They had a house. They spent half the year in France, in Paris, where William fancied himself an artist, although he wasn't really any good. And then they had this villa in near Cannes in the south of France. And, you know, so that was her. She was brought up. I guess she went to boarding school or finishing school at some point in her life. And she didn't never really worked much in her life. Even during when she was older, she was like a debutante, I suppose you could call her. She attended teas and social societies, met with other wealthy young women. During when World War II started, she did a bit of fundraising. This is even before the United States got involved in the war and after Pearl Harbor in December 1941. And she, you know, never was had any money problems and lived a very wealthy lifestyle. The death of her father, William, in 1940 from a heart attack, which ran in their family, and all the men died pretty young, including her grandfather, uncle, and her father, affected her deeply, obviously, and also set in motion her relationship with Wayne Lonergan, because it was the father, her father, William, was the one who had introduced her to Wayne. Whether or not she knew about her father's other life, I don't know. You know, the as I said, you know, homosexuality in the 1930s and 40s was like one of the worst things you could possibly be accused of. People hid it. It was against the law, both in Canada and the United States. In France, it was more illegal. You could do what you want, which maybe have been the attraction for living in France. But, you know, you could be arrested. Bartender serving a drink to two men, dancing on the floor or doing anything could have been, their place could have been shut down. And in New York, it was regarded as a sickness, perversion, a psychopath. You know, people were psychopath. It was regarded as learned behavior, just completely, not what most people would think of today, but plays a huge part in understanding of what went on. I was just actually watching, I don't know if you've seen the new Perry Mason series, but there was two of the characters are gay living in the 1930s in Los Angeles. And I thought to myself, as I watched it, you know, they had to hide their other life. And this man and woman who are both gay had to pretend to be a couple on the night on the town. And it's exactly the way it was in the book as well. And even in a cosmopolitan place like New York, it was dangerous to come out. So William, you know, William Burton probably had to be very careful. And thus he was married, although he gets divorced from his wife maybe about 5-6 years after they got married. And then strangely enough, 4 years later, they remarry. They said they later did it to help Patsy because they loved her so much. But even after they got remarried, they lived fairly separate lives And they, just before World War II, they came, although Lucille's lived in Europe a little longer, William brought Patsy back to New York, supposedly with all of his very expensive artwork. But I have since learned, since the book was published, and I can talk about this later, but I since learned that, in fact, he had left his villa to the French resistance, but apparently the Nazis had taken a lot of his artwork, and a film crew in Paris, France, that interviewed me about the case discovered that, in fact, the Nazis had taken it and they were trying to track down some of the artwork. But it gets into the story about what happened to their son, who's now 80 years old. And I can talk about it near after because it's quite fascinating. I learned something just recently, thanks to the interview these people did with me from this French TV station.
Let's get back to Wayne Lonergan and this marriage that eventually happens between the two, but the relationship and what it was characterized by.
Well, Wayne, you know, okay, so Wayne is born in 1918 in Toronto. He grows up in a fairly middle-class environment, although I think the most important thing in his life is his mother was ill. She had what we would call today a bipolar, and she dies fairly young. His father also dies young. He had two siblings. But Wayne spent a lot of his childhood in trouble with the law. He spent had stints at reformatories. And again, you know, he was said late, he had run-ins with the police, and, you know, he told them he was making money and dealing by being intimate with gay men. And again, sort of the beginning of this process. He has all sorts of other jobs trying to make something of himself. I mean, I think he really wants the good life. He's a bit of a liar. I think he continues that for all the rest of his life, to be honest. He eventually decides after being a lifeguard and a helper of a conductor and other sort of jobs, he gets a job in 1939 at the New York World's Fair, which was at the time this massive extravaganza in Queens, now this where the U.S. Open plays, and was also the site of the 1964 New York World's Fair. But in 1939, it was a really huge deal. And he got a job as a bus dispatcher. And through that, that brings him to New York. And at some point, he meets William Burton, Patricia's father. I believe, and according to all the documents I can find and other sources and other authors, and they probably have some sort of intimate relationship. William was about at least 18 to 20 years older than him, and introduces Wayne to this fairly expensive lifestyle, cafe society, going to the Stork Club in El Morocco. And through William, as I said, he's introduced to Patricia. When William dies in 1940, strange, bizarrely, whether again Patsy knew about who Wayne really was or what his relationship with her father was, they start to date. They go to this, their first date is allegedly, at least according to Wayne, because I could never find out if this was true, at the Stork Club, where Wayne is apparently treated, he's only like, you know, early 20s. He's treated with deference by the doorman who had all this power to let people into the club, because it was extremely difficult to get in. Whether that's true or not, I suspect that part of the story is not. Lucille was wary of Wayne, probably saw him as a bit of a hustler because that's what he was. She takes takes Patricia to Santa Barbara in California for a holiday. Wayne manages to scrum some money together and travel and visit her, and they decide to elope in Las Vegas, and she runs away with Wayne, and in the summer of 1941, they decide to get married. And they go to one of these, you know, hitching places in Las Vegas, which was
right,
well, more well known than gambling. And they come back to live there, life in New York. Wayne never works really a day in his life after that. Maybe a little bit, but not much. I mean, Patricia inherits a pretty good chunk of money from when her father dies. So, you know, she's living on a certain amount of money, you know, more than $1,000 every month. And she supports Wayne financially. She even supports him actually after they have problems. I mean, she's always giving him money. And he develops a very high taste in suits and a lot of shoes and monogrammed shirts. And, you know, so he's living this high lifestyle. He plays bridge all day. Doesn't get out of bed till 10:30 in the morning and doesn't do too much. And they spend a lot of evenings out, you know, trying to brush shoulders with the Broadway and Hollywood stars that are at the Star Club, the El Morocco, the 21 Club, and places like that where people would, you know, dance and into the night. And those clubs were famous for being, you know, you want to be seen, you want your picture taken by the photographer, you want to end up in the next day's gossip column by Walter Winchell or Dorothy Kilgallen or Ed Sullivan. And, you know, they were what I refer to as, you know, in those days, that's what it's like Twitter. You know, that was the whole object, to be
right,
to be seen and to be known. And Wayne, and they are mentioned, you know, they're sort of bit players really in the whole scheme of things until the murder, you know, because the last night of Patricia's life, she spends at the El Morocco, and the club was never really happy that they were associated with either of them. So, you know, that their marriage meantime is poor, even after the child is born. You know, Wayne's just a bit of a lout. I mean, he, according to one witness, a person who worked for them for a little while, they had servants, maids, and nannies, and so forth. You know, they said that, you know, Patricia would come home crying sometimes in the evening after they went out. Wayne would just sort of desert her at the club, and she'd be left on her own. I'm sure that's quite believable. And, you know, during this period of time, Wayne is, in fact, contacted by the U.S. government Selective Service about enlisting, even though he's a Canadian. He's actually still eligible to be drafted in the U.S. Army. And he is, in fact, twice he goes through this process. Once he gets away, he's just drunk and they dismiss him. Another, he uses the fact that he's a homosexual again to get out of. He's eventually declared 4F and is let go and not accepted because of her immorality. Again, the U.S. Army, it's just crazy how they had all these insane tests to try to determine if someone was homosexual. It's pretty, when you read about it today, you can't believe that they actually did this kind of stuff. They would, you know, strip a guy naked and start asking him all these sexual questions to see what his response would be, to determine, this was supposed to determine whether someone was gay, because they other than communists, I think the greatest fear was that homosexuals would get into the army. So Wayne is able to evade getting drafted, but, you know, there's a certain tension, I suppose, in their lives because of it. And by the, let's say, the June 1943, so this is like a year after their child is born, the marriage is in trouble, and ultimately Patricia kicks Wayne out of their apartment. They live at this nice place at the time on Park Avenue near 72nd Street. I stood in front of the building, still a beautiful building. And I was, that's by the way, just an aside, one of the great things about writing this book was, and because New York's so old, I could visit all the sites more or less, other than the clubs, the Stork Club and the El Morocco are long gone. But, you know, where Wayne Will lived and where Patricia lived, where the murder took place on 51st Street, it's all still standing. So you at least get a sense of the geography of the area, which is kind of interesting. And by this time, in fact, Patricia, so Wayne leaves. He does some work as a photographer for a little while, actually supported by Patricia again, who pays his tuition to this school of art to learn how to be a photographer and a photographer's assistant, which does Wayne gets a job. And then she decides she's going to move into this 51st Street townhouse, to ground floor and two other floors, the first two floors. And then above them is a family living on the third and fourth floor. So it's a really nice brownstone in a nice quiet area. Beekman Hill is a very fancy, quiet place area of the city. And it's sort of away from, like, off between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. Really nice. At some point, Wayne around this time decides he's going to enlist in the Royal Canadian Air Force. He wants, maybe he's trying to, he thinks the marriage can be saved. After one fight, he writes Patricia a bit of a love letter to try to make up with her. But by this time, she has actually written him out of her will, which I guess he does find out about it and probably does cause it. Because she, I should add that not only does she have this trust fund that her father left her, but because the father died and along with his brother, she is the sole inheritor of the estate of the Bernheimer family. She has a grandmother named Stella who had remarried once her husband died. But when Stella dies, and at the time, she doesn't actually die till 1954 after Patricia died. But you know, the estate is probably worth like $7-8 million, which is like, you know, about $60 million would have been about worth $60 million today or something right. along those lines. So she's destined to be a very, very wealthy woman when her grandmother dies. At least that's the idea. So, you know, maybe that's in the back of Wayne's mind as well. But he decides to enlist in the Air Force. And he does get it. They have a program at the University of Toronto downtown, and he's sort of learning, and he is allowed, because he has a kid, and even though travel is restricted during the Second World War for a variety of reasons between Canada and the United States, Wayne is allowed as a serviceman to visit New York and see his kid. And he goes there once or twice, once, I guess, late fall of 1943. And then he decides on this fateful weekend to come October 22nd, Friday, 1943, to see his son. And that's the weekend of the murder. And then there's the whole story of what happens at the weekend, which I can launch into if you like.
Let's talk about that day and also the plans that she had. You write that she had said to someone just previous to this that she had no animosity towards Wayne and wanted to continue their good relationship as she saw it. So she was not alarmed in any way by Wayne Lonergan.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say they had a good relationship, but she was decent enough to know that she cared about her son, that she did tell her maid and housekeeper, maid and the governess, Miss Elizabeth Black was the one who was really raising, his name was William, the little Billy, they called him. That Wayne was in New York, he could see the kid whenever he wanted to. And, you know, which was decent of her. She, again, as I said, she had this lifestyle, or even though she was separated, she started dating other men. In fact, the weekend of the murder, she was dating this Italian decorator, probably about 20 years older than her. His name was Mario Gabellini. He's quite a character. I'm sure he only wanted one thing from Patricia. But actually, just as another funny aside, I always thought this was a funny story. Initially, of course, when Patricia is found dead, they suspect Gabellini, this guy. So they get to his apartment and find him, his shirt. And his shirt has red stains on it, except when they examine it more closely, it turns out to be tomato sauce, not blood. So he was cleared. He had been married a few times. He was just a player. And, you know, after a young woman, obviously, who was rich. I'm sure that's all his story was. But, you know, he gets drawn into this story as well. So, you know, Wayne comes to New York. He stays at the apartment of a wealthy friend, a real, you know, elite guy named John Hargis, whose family is in the banking business in Europe and in New York. Him and Wayne had met, I probably through his contact with Patricia's family. And he, in fact, was an usher at Hargis's wedding, although Hargis's marriage also dissolved on grounds of cruelty. So he's living on this really nice place on 79th and Lexington, also still standing. And I talked to the doorman of the building. And Hargis has a wedding outside of the city for that weekend, but he's told there's a butler and a maid, a married couple. They live there named Peters and last name Peterson. And Wayne is allowed to stay in the apartment that weekend. He's wearing his Royal Canadian Air Force uniform because he was obligated to do that. And he stays there. Before Hargis leaves, he introduces him to this woman named Jean Murphy or Jean Jayberg. She's a divorced woman with a 7-year-old who was a showgirl, you know, mildly successful, though. She also later claimed her association with Lonergan ruined her career, which may or may not be true. She's a good-looking woman, and she was in a few, you know, chorus line kind of parts. Anyway, Wayne had tickets to a Broadway play, and Hargis sets her up with this woman who lives right next door to him in an adjacent apartment, adjacent building, rather. And Wayne goes out with her. So On the day of that Saturday, October 23rd, Patricia leaves her place, as you said, around noon to a friend. She leaves her child with Miss Black, fair enough. But really, she's gone from like noon Saturday, doesn't come back till 6:30 in the morning. She's out all night dancing with friends at the El Morocco with Gabellini. They meet other friends, then they have a late breakfast, and you know, she's gone for like 18 hours. It's, you know, it's you got to think it's a little unusual. I mean, she does have a child. So, but, you know, maybe I'm judging her too harshly. I'm not sure. In the meantime, Wayne is also out that night, Saturday night with Gene. They go to this Broadway play and they actually try to get into the El Morocco where they would have bumped into Patricia, but they didn't have reservations and they ended up going somewhere else. I think the Waldorf Astoria Hotel where they had supper. Wayne takes Gene Murphy back home. He later claims that they kissed each other goodnight. Gene Murphy says, no, there was no kiss. Well, you know, she was mildly liked Wayne. He was a pretty good looking guy and had a certain style, I imagine, and could tell a good story. But, you know, they go separate. When Wayne is later confronted by the police, his initial story is this concocted alibi that is just beyond silly. Yet, you know, eventually he does take it back, but the newspapers get a hold of it and it completely taints his reputation, I'm sure, among the jury members who later sat on that jury. And Wayne's story that he tells the assistant district attorney is that after he dropped off Gene Jayberg, he stopped for a cigarette outside the building because you had to walk outside between the two buildings where she lived and where Hargis's apartment was. And he has a cigarette and he bumps into this American soldier in uniform. They start to talking and Wayne invites him up to the Hargis's apartment. So he says, the Peters, the maid and the butler are sleeping. Wayne then says that they have homosexual intimacy and intimate relations, and that in the middle of the night, some kind of argument ensues in which Wayne is assaulted by the soldier who proceeds to rob him of his money and, strangely enough, take his uniform, his Royal Canadian Air Force uniform. Why a U.S. soldier would want to take a Royal Canadian Air Force uniform is interesting enough. And that's Wayne's story. Well, of course, you know, when the story was leaked, probably by police sources, because Wayne actually offers this story to a guy named John Lohr, who is like a deputy assistant attorney and whose family I tracked down. He was a young guy working with the assistant district attorney on that case. It was a guy named Grumet. John Grumet was his last name. And Lohr worked for him. Lorig flies to Toronto and interviews Wayne initially after the Toronto police had picked him up once because the New York police wanted him detained. He had left after the murder. He had gone back to Toronto. And Wayne tells Lorig this crazy story. Well, someone leaks it. And then it becomes part of the story as Wayne is, as the case is unfolding and the story of the murder is unfolding. The Daily News particularly has these huge pictures, and there's one I have in the book that, you know, it says top huge headline with a picture of Wayne coming down stairs of a plane. It says twisted sex, and, you know, he's described as being perverted. And the soldier's name, by the way, he comes up with a name. I always said it sounds like some name out of a Seinfeld episode. The guy's name is Morris Worcester. I don't quite know why he picked that name or who this guy was, but funnily enough, there wasn't really a guy named Morris Worcester who worked across New York in Connecticut and whose friend started razzing him that he was gay. So he comes forward at one point and declares that he's not the guy, the soldier that Wayne had met. I mean, the story is just so silly that, but it's just funny that he had come up with this name. And, you know, so Wayne, that's Wayne's story. And then the next day he says he has lunch with Gene Jayberg and her son at a restaurant. And then he drops off a gift for his son, Billy, not seeing anybody, just leaves the package in the vestibule, sort of this main entrance to the building on 51st Street, and then eventually leaves New York and flies back to Toronto. Well, you know, that's one version of the story. It's not the version of the truth, but it's the version that Wayne initially has. So Patricia, that same night, as I said, she was at the El Morocco and she was dancing, and Mario Gabellini eventually brings her home 6:30 in the morning. She doesn't invite him in. She's very tired. And she goes into her bedroom, locks the door and supposedly goes to sleep.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. If you were to start a new business, what would it be? A food cart business? a bouncy castle backyard parties business, a lawn and landscaping business. Whether you're starting a new business or a growing one, if you want it to be successful, you need the most talented people on your team. That's where ZipRecruiter comes in. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Why should you let ZipRecruiter help you hire for your business? Because ZipRecruiter's matching technology finds you qualified candidates and lets you then send them a personal invite to apply. Let ZipRecruiter fill all your roles with the right candidates. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We were going to talk about the official story, not the story that Wayne Lonergan gave to police.
Once her body is found, on the Sunday, her bedroom door remains shut. The governess is there looking after the Billy. All through the day, they're not sure exactly. No one hears from her. And eventually, Elizabeth, the governess, becomes concerned. They call over the mother, Lucille, who lives nearby. She attempts to get into the bedroom, and they can't. It's locked somehow. And ultimately, a friend, a big football player type guy who's in the Army, is going back to somewhere in North Carolina, I think, or one of those places too, for some training. He comes over and they decide he gets a screwdriver and he takes the hinges off the door, and they get into the bedroom where they discover her half naked body strewn, or she has a big gash on her head and she's lying sort of twisted on the bed and she's dead. There's a terrible scene, of course, as you can imagine. And right away, you know, the police come and they investigate, and then they discover through witnesses and through what the people who work for her told that her husband, that their separated husband had been in New York. And so he becomes a person of interest. The New York police authorities and the DA, they decide to track Wayne down. They ask the Toronto police to track Wayne down. They find him at a boarding house that he's living at near the University of Toronto downtown. And he willingly decides to come, you know, into custody. He didn't never ask for a lawyer ever. Like, then once he's in New York, nothing. Even though one of his relatives in New York, in Toronto, did offer, his uncle, I think, offered to get him a lawyer. But somehow the police, that was one of the issues that came up later, that the Toronto police had violated his rights. Although in those days, you know, the police had a lot more latitude than they would have today. Anyways, you know, Wayne wasn't treated poorly. The Toronto police just really hold him until New York detectives and this guy Lore flies in to question him. And so that takes place the following day. Like, it would have been the Monday they find him, and then on Tuesday, I guess, they get him. They question him, or maybe it was Monday night, even probably Tuesday. And Wayne then tells them this crazy story. But he agrees to go back to New York with them, again, not asking a lawyer. They take a train to Buffalo, and then there's kind of some kind of bureaucratic snafu where the detectives end up having to keep Wayne in a hotel in Buffalo overnight, where they handcuff him to a bed. Now, here's a guy who hasn't been charged with anything, but yet they're handcuffing him to a bed because they don't want him to leave. Yeah, that might be considered to be rather treatment that a lawyer could have dealt with, but never really comes up. Wayne then is brought to New York the next day. That's that picture of the twisted sex already. His statements is already known. And the papers already are talking about this crazy alibi. And then eventually, you know, he's brought to the district attorney's office in downtown New York, and where he eventually, Laura sort of weighs him down, tells him that his alibi about the homosexual relationship is not a good idea, that he's leaving a terrible legacy for his son, and berates him. Wayne eventually agrees to tell them what happened. But he doesn't want them questioning anything to do with his morality. He doesn't want his morals questioned or anything. Again, he later, by the way, I should say, years later, like in the 91, so he's actually released from prison. He gives an interview with the CBC in Toronto. He says the whole story of the alibi was just a ruse, that he made it up and it wasn't true. But at the time, it wasn't so clear that was the case. So eventually he decides he will confess. Again, never asking for a lawyer to be present when he's doing this, which is rather strange. But again, he's only 25 and not his birthday yet. And he tells them this story, which is a little more believable, that for whatever reason, on the Sunday morning, October 24th, he decided to go see Patricia. Maybe he thought they could reconcile, maybe not. Anyways, he shows up maybe 8:30 in the morning. It's a quiet Sunday morning. He knocks on her bedroom door. She's half asleep and she answers the door. She, you know, what are you doing here? But she lets him in. And then there's this interaction between them. You know, my view from what I can understand from the story and what happened is that ultimately the argument became heated. I believe that she told him, at least according to him, that she was going to not let him see their son anymore, and that just sort of triggered a reaction. Like many murders, you know, it wasn't premeditated. I don't think he went there with the intention, which is probably the reason why he was charged with second degree murder rather than first degree murder. But he just snapped and he reached for, on her night table, she had these onyx or glass statues with brass bases, and he threw one at her, or then struck her on the head with it, weakening her. And then he strangled her. And she died. And I don't know if he intended to, you know, just in a fit of rage. He had got blood on his uniform, which will explain why he had to get rid of it. And that's why he came up with this cockeyed story about the soldiers stealing it. None of the, you know, in those, you know, as I've said, if this case would have happened today, it probably would have been solved in 15 minutes with DNA. But there was no DNA testing, of course, in 1943. Even fingerprints, there was good fingerprinting, but nobody left enough fingerprints. There was blood found in the bathroom of Patricia's bedroom. But, of course, in those days, they didn't really know. They had blood grouping. In other words, they could have determined that someone was, type O, but big deal. You know, half the planet is type O. So that really didn't help at all. They had cigarette butts that both Wayne and Patricia smoked. Wayne was a chain smoker his whole life and ended up dying of cancer from it, probably. And he, you know, they couldn't determine whose cigarette it was or anything about it. So they had all these forensic experts there, you know, some of these doctors and other medical experts and police experts, but they didn't really introduce any of it into the trial. But they did have Wayne's confession. He said that he got out of the house without anybody seeing him. The only person who may have probably did hear the murder was this nanny who was taking care of the kid who lived in the suite above Patricia's on the third and fourth floor.
Right.
She was a German housekeeper, nanny, and young woman who came down for the paper. Heard somebody scream behind closed doors, then another scream, then silence. Didn't hear a man's voice, just a woman's voice. Decided not to call the police. She was about to knock on the door and see if everybody was okay, but chose not to. Later said that it wasn't really my place. And you know, that's how she saw the situation. And whether or not she probably did hear the murder, but I could never try. I don't know what happened to her. I was unsuccessful in trying to figure out what happened. She probably got married, changed her name. And I did talk to people. I talked to the daughter of the family that lived above, but you know, no one alive was still around that lived in that apartment. That this woman had been born after the family moved, but she did clue me into the family. And then Wayne eventually, and he takes some crazy route back to Hargis's place, which I followed a walk. He's back and forth between First and Second and Third Avenue. And anyways, he gets back to Hargis, so somehow again managed to get into the apartment without the butler and the maid seeing him at Hargis's place, takes off the uniform, showers, and then he finds a duffel bag that he had. He takes the uniforms, cuts it up, puts it in the duffel bag, and then takes a dumbbell that Hargis has and then walks to the East River. Now, two things that he does at this point. He takes a florist who he in the neighborhood walking her dog on a Sunday morning sees Wayne from a distance carrying the duffel bag. And that's all she can testify to. She doesn't know anything about it, but she says she did see him. I think when he took it to the East River, which wasn't too far, and there's a fence there, he threw the duffel bag, weighted down with that's where the uniform was, and it sinks, and the police were never able to find the duffel bag for whatever reason. Wayne never explains properly what happened to that uniform or where it is or what he did with it or know, or what, anything really about it or why, what happened to it. He then goes to a pharmacist and gets, Patricia had scratched him and he got some makeup, which the drug, the pharmacist somewhat remembers someone buying the makeup, like Max Factor makeup, theatrical makeup. And he covers the scratches on his neck, which is the reason when he has lunch that day with Jean Murphy, he claims that he didn't have any scratches. But you can see plainly in a picture that was taken in the later, like after they apprehended him, that he does have scratches under his neck or chin, around his chin. And clearly, again, scratch. Again, DNA evidence could have proven that it was Patricia, but they didn't have, weren't available. And then he drops off the present. He goes back to her apartment, drops off the present for his kid, leaves, no one sees him. And then he gets out of New York eventually and then comes back. And then the Toronto police show up the next day. So, you know, that's the story of likely she died. Wayne is then, you know, put on trial for second degree murder. But the only, you know, the only real evidence they have is the confession. Later, he has, actually, there are two trials. One is called off and they have to start a second one soon after. But he's got this bombastic lawyer, you know, a big, huge guy named Ed Broderick. And he causes fits for the DA and the judge, trying to every which way to figure out how to help Wayne. Wayne, you know, against the confession. And the only thing he, of course, could come up with is that somehow the confession is coerced. So Wayne uses this coerced confession excuse. He brings it up, his lawyer brings it up at the trial. And it's, and 20 years later, it's also brought up, partially because the law about confessions in New York changes. In those days, you know, okay, let's look at it two ways. One, I can tell you that even though we know that the police did beat confessions out of people and innocent people do go to jail, I mean, clearly in New York and elsewhere in the United States and in Canada, it happens. I don't believe it was the case in this. I have affidavits from every single person in that room. Wayne was treated enormously by everybody, really. He was never, other than being locked in a hotel room in Buffalo, that's about the worst thing that happened to him. I mean, he was given cigarettes, food, water, everybody in the room treated him respectfully. No one coerced him. They, you know, he could have had a lawyer. He chose not to. And I know, so he was never, his confession was not.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/diagram now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more features like advanced shapes, dependency mapping, and two-way Jira syncing. Get started today at MIRO.com/diagram now.
Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Coerced, and nor did any appeal court ever find that it was. The only thing in New York was at the time, and in other states, they had various ways in which confessions were treated in a trial. And in New York had one of the worst ways, really, is that the jury themselves could decide whether the confession was coerced in the 1940s. Other states had it that the judge had to at least consider this issue before the jury saw it. And the judge would decide whether they should see it or not. Later, in the early 1960s, the New York confession rule, or the way they did it, was found to be unconstitutional, which triggered a whole bunch of legal problems for New York prosecutors, because a lot of trials that had confessions had to be reexamined. And one of them was Wayne's. And that's ultimately why he gets a hearing in 1965. He's been in prison.
Let's stop for a second for these messages.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Let's get to the trial and the verdict before we talk about the effort to try to get him out on appeal once he is convicted.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, the trial is the second trial. The first was called off because of his lawyer's antics. The judges got so exasperated. He gets in another trial with a guy who was a little tougher. A former DA was the judge. It got a lot of publicity in the press. People were lined up. A lot of reporters from all over the world came. You know, as I said, he literally pushed the Second World War off the front pages for a little while. That certainly was the case in New York and Toronto, and there was a lot of publicity. And he doesn't testify on his own behalf as he could have. You know, they call the various witnesses describing their, you know, what went on between the two of them. But alas, you know, it's the jury. Does the DA plays games with the defense? The defense attorney is in New York up to very recently. The prosecution is under no obligation to give any evidence at all or telling anything they have, any witnesses they're going to call, to the defense attorney. And that really only changes within the last couple of years, believe it or not. I know in Canada, the 1990s, this change in which they had to have disclosure rules in Canada, that, you know, they were defense attorneys are now can get access to information that the Crown prosecutor have. But in New York, it took a long time to do that. And so, you know, defense attorneys were at a complete disadvantage. But Broderick attempted all sorts of things. I mean, Grumet doesn't give him the medical examiner's report, let's say, which I have copies of. I have the whole report was maybe 30 pages. He gives Broderick about 20 pages, 25 pages. But the funny thing is there's nothing I compared them. I mean, the main thing that he gave the defense attorney was how she died and the contusions on her head and the strangled, what the medical examiner found. So there's nothing in the other pages of any consequence, really. But he decided not to give them to him. And Broderick, of course, decided that this was some kind of trick and that if he could get the whole medical examiner's report, he'd find information that would exonerate Wayne, which was that not the case. But he was just, you know, essentially toying with him. It's kind of strange. It's this gamesmanship, I suppose you could call it, that they played. And the jury is left with Wayne's confession, which they ultimately believed. All men, because it's funny, on the trial, women were interviewed to be on the jury, but they didn't think women could stomach the stuff about Wayne's life and the homosexuality. It's just ridiculous, really. Mm-hmm. So the men are on this jury, and they decide within, they didn't have to meet very long to decide that Wayne was guilty. And he is sent to Sing Sing initially, and then ends up in Dannemora, Clifton Prison, I think it is.
Yes.
And where he's convicted for, he gets a 30-year sentence. He ends up serving from 1944 till 1965. In that period of time, he decides that, you know, he'd been railroaded and cheated and that his confession was coerced. And, you know, by the time he later tells the story in this hearing in 1965, as I said in the book, you know, it's he describes his experience as being akin to the Spanish Inquisition. I mean, he's had all these years in prison to come up with the story, and he takes full advantage of that. But, you know, the only other thing about him is that he also, once he gets out of prison, gives an interview on CBC that I mentioned. And he's got, I guess maybe from being around New Yorkers for all those years, but he's got this thick, Bronx kind of New York accent and uses the phrase forget about it and everything. It's pretty funny. I only had the audio files. I couldn't find the actual visuals of this TV show, This Hour Has 7 Days, which was like a early version of 60 Minutes that was on CBC, a very controversial show. And I actually talked to the journalist who interviewed him, who died recently, and LaFoley just passed away. And, you know, he was probably in his 80s. And, he did remember Wayne. But, you know, Wayne gets another lawyer, another controversy woman, Francis Kahn, who tries all sorts of tricks and uses the change in the law in New York to get this hearing. And so the whole thing is reconvened again in 1965, and just before Wayne is released on parole. And, you know, once he's released, they deport him back to Toronto. And, you know, the hearing doesn't go anywhere. There's really no written decision. They just refuse to overturn his conviction or anything like that. So he gets out in 1965. He ends up back in Toronto. Scott Young of the Globe and Mail, a columnist who's Neil Young's father, the musician, takes an interest in the case and in Wayne. Initially, he helps him, interviews him, and actually sets up this interview that Wayne gives in December 1965 once he's back. And, you know, interesting in that interview too, I always thought Wayne, the actual interview went for about 4 hours of time. Wayne never once mentions Patricia's name. He only calls her my wife. And his line when he was asked by LaFoley, did you kill your wife? He says, my position is no. That was his response. Kind of telling, I suppose. You know, he's a liar, but he initially said he goes to London for a while, actually. He gets a passport and is able to get to London, then comes back to Toronto and ends up being taken in by yet another woman who fascinates him, a comedic actress in Canada named Barbara Hamilton, mm-hmm. who looks after him. And I had an interesting conversation with the late Gordon Pinsett, the actor who knew Wayne and was friends with Barbara Hamilton. Him and his wife were friends. And his daughter, Leah, who's also an actress, also remembered Wayne. Leah, who was like 12 at the time, probably thought Wayne in the 60s was rather creepy. He didn't talk much. Gordon Pinsett said that Wayne drank a lot of Drambuie and scotch and didn't say much. Barbara Hamilton had a rule that when she was interviewed, no one was ever allowed to ask her about Wayne or Wayne's other life. And I'm assuming she thought that he had been railroaded or was innocent. And then he died. You know, he died in 1986. He probably never saw his son again. When he got out of prison, his son was raised by Patricia's mother, Lucille, who died in 1966. Apparently, Wayne tried to contact the boy, but I think, from what I understand, he got a letter back from lawyers saying not to do this. So I'm assuming he never did. The last piece of, you know, any kind of some mention of the boy in the news, his name was changed to Burton from Lonergan. So she changed his name to Burton. He sort of fades away. There's some mention of him going to Harvard in the 1960s. This is what I just learned, though, and it was kind of interesting. I was sort of searching for him. I wasn't sure what I could ask him because he was only like, you know, 18 months old when all this was happening. So right. His father was accused of killing his mother, who he doesn't remember anyways. And he's also very wealthy. He's the one who inherited his grandmother's money eventually when she died in 1954. I thought I found where he lived in New York by the name, and I was reticent about contacting him. I had read Dominic Dunn had written about the story in a Vanity Fair article that he subsequently published in a book. He had chapters on true crime. One of them was, in fact, Lonergan's story. They got a lot of the facts wrong. But he did say that he, too, didn't decide not to talk to the kid. Because, you know, it was just sort of traumatic. So I sort of followed that. But I always sort of felt ambivalent about it. I sort of felt like I should have tried to talk to him. At least he might have been able to tell me more about the grandmother. But I'm not sure what his reaction would have been. But this French TV station did find him. And I recently saw their video of the interview with him, which I am also in the show. So he knows about my book. I mean, they didn't. A French TV journalist who I spoke to decided not to ask him about the murder because she thought it was too disrespectful. But he, you know, he's this old guy, he's wealthy, living in New York, and he's exactly the person who I thought he was. He just turned 80, he would have been 80 in 2021. So he's like, you know, going to be 83 in a few weeks. So that I thought was interesting. And I'm not sure, you know, he seems like sort of a strange kind of guy, to be honest, but he's elderly and who knows exactly his life. I'm not sure if he married. I don't think he had any children. But I thought that was interesting. And the fact that they found out that a lot of William Burton's goods were stolen from by the Nazis from this villa in France. And thus ends the story.
Yes, I want to thank you so much, Alan Levine, for coming on and talking about your book, Details Are Unprintable, Wayne Lonergan and the Sensational Cafe Society Murder. For those that might want to take another further look at your work, can you tell us about your website and if you do any social media?
Yeah, www.alanlevinebooks.com. You can find information. The book is available on Amazon and all other book sites. And you can find me on Twitter at alanlevine12. And there's some periodic stuff about that as well.
Thank you so much, Alan Levine. Details are unprintable. Wayne Lonergan and the Sensational Cafe Society Murder. Thank you for this interview. And have a great evening.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/diagram now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more features like advanced shapes, dependency mapping, and two-way Jira syncing. Get started today at miro.com/diagram now.
Night.